Hello, med students. My name is Phil Leger, and thank you for downloading this episode of the EM Clerkship Podcast. This is an EM Bolus episode. We have a great interview in store for you today. Zach and I work really hard to try and put content together that you will enjoy. The EM Bolus format is a relatively new idea. It's just kind of getting rolling. And I really wanted to get people that would be really interesting to hear what they are up to in the world of medicine. And I think that's what we have for you today. The interview today is with Dr. Samuel Tischerman. He is a professor in surgery at the University of Maryland Medical Center, and he is leading a trial currently that has the potential to change trauma resuscitation as we know it. Now, when this idea was originally, you know, put forth in our little brainstorming sessions with Zach and I, we were like, wow, are we going to email the University of Maryland and just ask him for an interview with this guy? And I said, well, yeah, I mean, you know, all they can do is say no. And that's exactly what they didn't do. They took our request. They took it right to Dr. Tischerman. We set up the time and date, and he sat with us for an interview to explain what he is currently working on. Now, what you won't hear are any results. And the reason is because this is not a trial that had been published and it's been gone through and reviewed and so forth. This is a researcher in the middle of his trial that is currently happening right now at Baltimore Shock Trauma. And if you don't know what we're talking about when I say Baltimore Shock Trauma, look it up. Really, really high-speed place. There are a couple really great documentaries that take you inside how they operate and how they work and the design of it. But, you know, Wikipedia article will do you. And so these people, essentially the gist of it is they're no strangers to trauma. So Dr. Tischerman teams up with these folks, and they're currently in the middle of this trial, and we get to talk to him today. So without any further ado, ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Sam Tischerman. Dr. Tischerman, can you tell us who you are and what your current position and title is?
I'm a professor of surgery in the program in trauma of the University of Maryland School of Medicine.
And doctor, can you just outline for us what EPR is? Can you tell our listeners just the basics of what they need to know about EPR?
EPR stands for Emergency Preservation and Resuscitation. The idea is that patients currently who come in with cardiac arrest from trauma have frequently bled to the point of the heart stopping. So in that situation, what we currently do just doesn't work very well. We ventilate them, we give them fluids and blood products, and we even go as far as opening the chest to directly compress the heart and potentially fix any injuries we find in the chest. Despite that, the survival is around 5%. So the idea behind EPR is that these patients often have injuries that are fixable, but we just can't stop the bleeding fast enough. So if we use hypothermia, and we're talking about cold temperatures down to 10 degrees centigrade, which is about 50 Celsius, or 10 Celsius, which is 50 Fahrenheit, we can decrease the body's need for oxygen and thereby allow a period of cardiac arrest during which the trauma surgeon can get control of the bleeding. And then, since the patient's so cold, we have to use a heart-lung machine to start blood flow again and start warming the patient up.
So this idea of EPR, for our listeners, this is not something that was thought of a year ago, 5 years ago. This has been in the works for a long, long time. Can you tell us a little bit about that? How long have you been working on this or kind of leading to this?
The idea for this goes back to the late 80s. Dr. Peter Saffer, who's known as the father of CPR, at the time I was working in the lab with him, and we were doing some of the early work on just a little bit of cooling, mild hypothermia after a cardiac arrest. And we started thinking about whether this could be applicable to the trauma patient. The problem with the trauma patient, as we just discussed, is that CPR just doesn't work. You can't just press on the chest or even directly compress the heart and get any blood flow. So you got to do something different. And we thought that the hypothermia idea might help, and we have to go down to very cold temperatures to do that. The other piece of this is that we looked at data from the Vietnam War, and a lot of soldiers who died of their wounds actually have fixable injuries. So it's really a matter of just buying time to stop the bleeding and get control of the situation. The other two things that came into play were that there are multiple reports of people who drown in cold water and are underwater for an hour or more, but could survive and do well. The other thing is that cardiac surgeons have been using very cold temperatures. They usually go down to about 15 centigrade for doing procedures where they have to stop all the circulation to the body to be able to do what they have to do technically. So those are operations on the aorta or babies with congenital heart defects. So all that led us to thinking that this very deep level of hypothermia might be the answer to the problem that we're dealing with trauma patients.
I understand it takes about 15 to 20 minutes to get to the targeted temperature. Is that correct?
That's what we experienced when we were doing this in a laboratory, and as we're gaining experience with it in patients, we'll sort out how much time it takes for a human.
What were the considerations between the cases where people were immersed in water versus what EPR is, which is basically a full fluid volume replacement?
So one of the things about patients who are under cold water is that we think the patients who actually survive get cold enough fast enough that they have some protection of the brain, which is really the most vital and most vulnerable organ that we're looking at here. The brain's cooled enough by the time the heart stops that they have some protection. And similarly, when the cardiac surgeons do this, they're doing it electively. They're taking a person who's warm and doing okay, and they cool them down, and then they stop the circulation to do the operation. For us, we're kind of doing it in the opposite direction. So we're already behind the eight ball because the person's already bled to the point of cardiac arrest, and now we're quickly trying to buy some time and use the hypothermia to do this. The best way that we've come up with to cool the core of the body, get the brain cold, the heart cold, vital organs cold, is to basically pump a very large amount of ice cold fluid, and we just use saline solution to do this. And that way we're cooling the core of the body. Anything externally would take way too long to do this. So our goal with the cold fluid isn't so much to get rid of the blood. It's just that that's the fastest way that we've come up with to cool the vital organs.
The decision to do the EPR on a trauma patient, the time frame for that decision is pretty quick. Is that correct?
Right. I mean, we're talking about within a couple minutes of doing standard care.
In that small window, how important is it for that patient to be adequately pre-oxygenated? And in addition to that question, how important is the pre-hospital care before they get to you?
Well, I think what we certainly always have to do is optimize that care. I mean, one of the things at this stage of the game is we want to make sure that we've given standard care the best chance to have success with resuscitating the patient. Although we also don't want to wait too long to intervene with something new so that it's too late to try something new. Certainly in the pre-hospital side of things, giving oxygen and ventilation, maybe giving fluids, may not be that critical in general for these kind of patients. I think, we're certainly leaning toward the old scoop and run kind of strategy for a trauma, because it's hard to definitively show that some pre-hospital interventions really make a difference other than getting the patient quickly to the hospital. I mean, there has been some work on giving blood products outside the hospital. And that might, in somebody who's essentially bleeding to death, might not be a bad thing. It's really hard to know just yet, but certainly if we have something novel to try and something more that can be done for the patient even without an EPR study, getting to the hospital as fast as possible is certainly what should be done. And when the patient gets to the hospital, the most important thing is getting the bleeding stopped and getting the blood replaced. Whether it's that critical or adds to the outcome to be sure that we're oxygenating well, that's hard to know. Certainly, the standard of care is going to be that we ventilate the patient as best we can, whether that's initially with bag valve mass ventilation or intubating once they're in the trauma bay. But the focus has to be on the bleeding.
This is a patient population that's coming from the Baltimore area, probably pretty quickly close to Baltimore shock trauma. How was the process in terms of just engaging the community, and what was that experience like?
So, and one thing that the listeners should be aware of is that people have been doing resuscitation trials for a while, and over that time frame, the resuscitation researchers, along with ethicists and national organizations, particularly the FDA, have been involved in trying to figure out how to ethically do studies like this. And there are a lot of studies being done that have similar issues. I mean, the basic problem is that there's no way to get consent prospectively from the patient that's in a situation like this. There's really no way to get consent from a family member either, because the vast majority of the time, they're not there. And even if they are, they're in a severe state of stress because their family member just got injured. And there's no time, particularly for this kind of study, where we're talking about making a decision within just a few minutes of the patient arriving at the hospital. So we have to have a acceptable way to conduct these kinds of studies without actually asking the patient ahead of time about their being involved in it. So what's evolved over time has been a process of what's called community consultation and public disclosure. So they're two pieces of the same plan. So the community consultation means actually reaching out to the community that's at risk of potentially being enrolled in the study and getting their feedback. And the public disclosure piece is more of a one-way street of just getting information out to the public. So what we've done here was that we issued a press release, which got picked up readily by the local media. So that led to a couple stories in the local papers, as well as interviews by local radio and TV. And then we reached out to the community in a few different ways. We went to several community events, like a health fair, farmers market, where there are other people there from the medical center talking about other health-related topics. And people came up to us, and we explained what we were doing. They asked questions, and we had them fill out a survey related to the process. We also had surveys in the trauma clinic. Obviously, patients who are coming back who had trauma are a population of people who are at risk for injury. And we also established a website, eprstudy.com, and that has information about the study as well as an opportunity to fill out the survey. And I will say that the response from the community was very strongly positive. People recognize the problem. They understand we don't have other good solutions, and they have great respect for shock trauma. So they feel positive about this institution trying something novel like this. So it was very positive experience.
I went to the website, actually. You made a YouTube video kind of explaining the process to the people, right? You on that website just sort of is you on YouTube explaining this is what we're trying to do and why, right?
Right, right. That was actually made when I was still in Pittsburgh, because we did go through the same kind of process in Pittsburgh, too, and got the trial up and running for just a little while there.
And did you yourself go out into the community and pass out flyers and answer questions?
I did.
What was that like? Did you same sort of experience? People pretty positive, asking questions, trying to understand.
Yeah, I think it varied. I mean, some people just kind of took the survey and filled it out, or took the University of Maryland Medical Center lip balm that we were handing out and walked away. But some really engaged and asked questions. A number of them felt that that shock trauma was a great place. A lot of people have had experience with their relatives or themselves coming here as patients, so they know the institution. And to be honest, there were a few people who said, "Oh, you guys are just treating us as guinea pigs." And but that there's going to be people that feel that way. I think the challenge I put out to them, if they really want to have a conversation about it, is here's a problem. We got patients who have a 5% chance of living with what we're doing now. I mean, we want to try something new. There's no way to try it in other patients because they don't have the same problems. So it's not a matter of us looking at them as guinea pigs. It's a matter of we're trying to do something novel to save them.
There's actually a lot of really good documentation on how shock trauma operates. Your colleague, Dr. Scalia, and his team over at Baltimore Shock Trauma, and there have been some documentaries filmed there and a lot of filming on how it operates, a lot of people around, that kind of thing. Just touching on the logistics of EPR, what has been your experience on how logistics heavy or how much pre-setting, pre-training of staff? What has your experience been getting that together, that piece of it?
That's been a huge piece of it. It's very complicated. So this involves, obviously, the trauma surgeons and the trauma team. But then the next piece of this is the cooling part, and that requires using basically the cardiopulmonary bypass pump to pump a large amount of saline into the patient. And the person that runs the pump is typically a perfusionist who works with the cardiac surgeons in the operating room. So we got to have perfusionists involved. And then once the patient's cold and now still with cardiac arrest, we get to the operating room and the trauma surgeon has to do what he or she has to do in terms of trying to find the bleeding sources. At the same time, now the cardiac surgeon has to be involved to basically put the patient on full bypass. So they've got to put an additional cannulas to be able to do that. And then they're going to work with the perfusionist to start up the pump and start circulating blood again. Then there's also cardiac anesthesiologists. And a lot of this is dependent upon the institution, but these are the kinds of people we have involved here. So now you're looking at an operating room that has two surgical teams operating, the perfusionist running a pump, potentially for a while at least two different subspecialized anesthesiologists at the head of the bed. So it gets complicated. And then there's some basic logistics up front of making sure that all the fluids available and cold and the cannulas and other instruments that the surgeons may need in the resuscitation area are ready to go. So all that needs to be in place. So I mean, this is one of very few places that can actually do all that and also have all support of those groups. I can certainly see at some institutions, if I went to the head of cardiac surgery and said, hey, would you mind if some of your staff would help us with this project? We're going to take trauma patients who've bled to the point of cardiac arrest and pump a large amount of saline into them, and then we want to put them on full bypass. You know, they might look at me like I've got two heads. But, I mean, that's one of the strengths of the University of Maryland Medical Center that, you know, I went to the chief cardiac surgeon, and he said, great, I got this young surgeon that would love to help you out with doing this, and Dr. Scalia and the whole trauma group is very much behind it. So the institution's behind it. Now, having said that, looking down the road, if we consider this works, then we want to make sure that the use of it can spread. And we've been working on ideas of how to make it easier, once we show that we can do it, how to make it easier for other institutions to do it, like coming up with easier cannulation techniques to get the cannulas into the patient quickly, maybe smaller, more easily used pumps that don't require a full perfusionist to handle it. So our long-term goal is that we can make this more user-friendly, and that way it could spread to other types of institutions and ideally even take it outside the hospital. You know, our funding comes from the Department of Defense because they recognize the clinical problem, and they do believe that with the right studies and with the right technology, they could take this farther forward near the battlefield.
That notion of the procedure being able to spread to a lot of different institutions, that's something really, really important. And it's interesting to hear you say that there's possibility for even other technologies to come out of just attempting this procedure in terms of, like, you know, the ability to cannulate a little quicker or to, you know, run bypass machines without so much staff resources. But being resource heavy, you know, that's an interesting sort of perspective on running a trial like this.
We specifically felt that we had to start with currently available technology. We do have the technology, it's just a matter of we need a lot of help to make it work. If we were trying to do this with something brand new that's never been approved for patient use, and then do it in a situation that's certainly well out there in terms of standard of care, that would be more difficult to get approvals. We still needed to get approval from the FDA in order to do the study, because we're using currently available fluids and pumps and catheters in ways that the FDA hasn't approved.
How did the staff react to the idea of doing EPR?
Well, this is a testimony to the type of people that work at Shock Trauma, because everybody that's been involved has been very excited about it. I mean, as an example, the first time we had a meeting of the people in the trauma resuscitation unit to discuss some of the logistics, I sort of thought, you know, maybe three or four people will come down and we'll have a good discussion about it. But I was told that they kind of fought over who could break away to come down for this meeting. And we had like 10 people. All of them were rich with ideas. And it's all a matter of just brainstorming. How can we make this happen?
A real team effort there. That's great.
Yeah. Well, it's worth at least keeping in mind that what we're doing does go against the current standard of care and perhaps I could say a dogma related to trauma care, because certainly the standard is to keep patients warm. We worry about coagulopathy and bleeding related to hypothermia. If you look at the literature, there's plenty to suggest that the trauma patients who happen to get colder do worse. But I believe in my heart that that the hypothermia is a marker of how badly injured they are, and not necessarily the cause of why they do worse. So I think that there is some benefit of this. And, you know, as I talk about it with people, I mean, I think there would be very little interest if I said, patients who are in shock from trauma, let's just cool them down a little bit and see if that helps. That wouldn't get a whole lot of excitement. But here we're talking about people that are in cardiac arrest from trauma, and we know that our current strategies lead to some very poor outcomes. People are just very excited that even though, you know, hypothermia is, you know, sort of taboo in the trauma world, it's worth a shot in this situation.
Dr. Tishman, do you have any pearls of wisdom or advice for our students out there that might be listening and wondering how they might follow in your footsteps?
Well, I'll add a couple points. I think, you know, one thing that's very helpful early in career is to find a good mentor or mentors. I was incredibly lucky that I answered an ad as a medical student looking for students to do cardiac arrest research. And when I answered the ad, I had no idea that the person who put the ad up on this little piece of paper on a bulletin board, just, you know, to go back to what things were like back then, the person who put out the ad was the person who first showed that mouth-to-mouth resuscitation works and really started the ABCs of CPR. So that, you know, led my career a certain path. And I found it important, you know, perhaps it was working with Dr. Stafford, but the idea of not necessarily accepting dogma or accepting poor outcomes and thinking of new ideas, new ways to do things. And if you're going to do that, you got to be vigilant and systematic and, you know, really go after it. And to me, at least, you know, finding a problem, a clinical problem that you want to tackle in a way that you can actually try to make a difference in patients will be something that'll keep you busy for the rest of your career.
Dr. Samuel Tishman is the lead researcher on the EPR trial at Baltimore's Shock Trauma and a professor in surgery at the University of Maryland Medical Center. Dr. Tishman, thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, thanks for having me. Enjoyed talking to you. For the students and listeners out there, keep working hard, keep studying, and be sure to enjoy your shift.
Okay, med students, really hope you enjoyed that interview with Dr. Tishman. He was really, really gracious to take some time out of his day and sit for an interview with us. I'm sure he's very, very busy, but he was so gracious to do it, and we really appreciate it. A couple things here on the end. Remember to follow us on Twitter. You can follow Zach at EM Clerkship, and you can follow me, Phil, at EM Clerkship, and the number 2 right on the end. Send me an email. Let me know what you think of the EM Bolus format, the shows, the interviews, anything you want. Talk about anything at all. You can reach me at Phil with 1L at emclerkship.com. Phil with 1L at emclerkship.com. Also, remember, the core EM episodes, EM, our base, launches every Sunday thanks to Zach. And to keep an eye out for those episodes, make sure you tell your iPod or your phone or whatever you're using to let you know that those episodes are launching. And that's it. So, hope you have a nice day, and thanks for downloading. Bye-bye.